Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Adults with mental illness make up 16% of the U.S. population, but they receive half of all opioid prescriptions. That's the pretty shocking conclusion of a new study from Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center and the University of Michigan. And researchers themselves seemed a bit shocked, say they didn't expect doctors would be giving out opioids so freely to these patients in particular, given heightened concerns about addiction and other side effects. So now the questions are, why is this the case and what should be done about it? And that's what we're asking today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have four guests with us in studio. Dr. Gary Solbison, family physician with Concord Family Medicine. Peter Evers, president and CEO of Riverbend Community Mental Health and Vice President for Behavioral Health at Concord Hospital, Dr. Quentin Turnbull, psychiatrist with the Mental Health Center of Greater Manchester, and Dr. Brian Seitz, Professor of Anesthesiology and Orthopedics at Dartmouth, co-author of a study that found that, again, as I said, unexpectedly high percentage of opioids going to people with mental health disorders. Welcome, all of you. It's great to see everyone. And Dr. Seitz, I did want to start with you, since you are co-author of this study. How surprising is this?
Well, when we started the study, we were not actually sure what the relationship between mental health disorders and opioid prescribing would be. There was actually some concern that patients suffering from these disorders may not be getting their fair share of opioids because physicians may be more conservative with their prescribing based on the recognition that such patients may have a higher likelihood of opioid abuse, overdose, and addiction in long-term use. So it was not clear at that time what we'd find. And then we got the complete opposite of some of our assumptions. We found this very large disproportional prescribing to this vulnerable group. And I remember when my co-researcher called me from University of Michigan after the analyst did the first pass, he said, "You won't believe this."
Wow.
So it was
so you
striking.
Went in thinking that people with mood disorders, anxiety, depression might actually not be getting opioids as much as the general population, given what we know about this group of patients and proclivities for addiction to these drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. Some experts were – actually, I think one of them on the show was suggesting that potentially could be the case. So that was a real surprising the magnitude of the prescribing.
So put this in the bigger picture for us. We've done tons of coverage here on NHPR about opioids, but just remind us how this fits into the larger context.
So I think everybody's aware that we're in the middle of a devastating opioid epidemic, but it's largely fueled by the massive increase in prescriptions for opioid painkillers over the past 15 years. And the U.S. is only 5% of the world's population, but is now consuming nearly 80% of the world's opioids. On top of that, the CDC reports that despite this increase in opioids and the associated tragedies, the American experience with pain has actually not improved.
So all these pills awash in this country and our experiences with pain have not gotten any better.
That's correct. Now, that's obviously on a population health level. On an individual level, these drugs may be absolutely appropriate and effective. But on a population health level, there's some deep concerns about some of the side effects and complications that we're all seeing in our communities.
Dr. Solbison, what do you make of this? It's so interesting to hear Dr. Seitz say, you know, he went into this research thinking folks with mental illness would be getting less in terms of opioid prescriptions. And it turns out, lo and behold, they're getting more, way more.
Well, that's sort of – it's interesting to listen to that perspective because as a family physician, I don't think there would be any of us or any primary care doctors who would suggest that your initial point wasn't intuitive, that, in fact, the mentally ill are high consumers of all medical services are in fact more consciously aware of many somatic symptoms, many physical symptoms that often lead to prescribing in many areas of medicine, not the least of which is pain management and opioids. So it's a somewhat different perspective. I also think it's important to consider, I mean, I think the study was very enlightening, but you have to consider the timing of this. And correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Seitz, this data precedes some of our recent attention, at least in New Hampshire, to this epidemic. And we have some evidence that, in fact, our recent attention and concerns about high-risk populations and opioid abuse have, in fact, reduced our utilization, particularly to high-risk populations. We have in New Hampshire, for example, laws that require us to assess special risks of certain populations that do help primary care physicians and others who prescribe opioids to identify high-risk populations. But those are new.
How new are they?
Well, the emergency rules went in place about a year and a half ago, and the final regulations really started this year. And again, preliminary data is very encouraging. Again, I'm not saying that means that we're going to eradicate opioid abuse or opioid overprescribing even, but I do think it's had a big impact, and I do think it's important data like this, which is incredibly enlightening to all of us, to kind of see it from a practical viewpoint, too.
So were you less surprised, perhaps, Dr. Sobelson, you know, that people with, given what you have seen about the pain that people with mental illness suffer, you were less surprised that they?
I was definitely not surprised. I certainly felt like it validated something that primary care physicians of all stripes are seeing, which is that as the primary care community has assumed much more of the burden of managing not only the pain management of this population, but in fact the mental health needs of this, prescribing needs of this population, that this kind of data would come forth.
Well, and we'll talk more and more later on about how family physicians, general practitioners, are tending to the mental health needs of people more and more. But to move to you, Peter Evers, again, with Riverbend Community Mental Health, Vice President for Behavioral Health at Concord Hospital. What's your take, just real broadly, on this data that the Dartmouth study finds?
Yeah, I think I wasn't surprised when you think about the presentation of people who have mental illness. I always think about the sort of co-occurring is really the key word here. Most of the people that we serve struggle with other issues such as substance use disorder and also pain. You know, I mean, there are so many co-occurring medical disorders with people who struggle with mental illness that are really not adequately treated. And so I think, you know, there's a sort of close association of psychic pain and physical pain. And when I was reading this, I wasn't surprised because a lot of people self-medicate. A lot of people want to feel numb. And, you know, I always think about opiates. And when people talked in the old days about getting high, it's the absolute opposite of that, really. You know, these are people who are numbing themselves because they're in tremendous psychic pain. So I think you're skewed in some ways with this population who are not actively drug-seeking as such, but actively seeking to rid themselves of pain.
When you talk about, you know, not being surprised, the people you see, lots of co-occurring problems, can you just give us a sort of down-to-earth, for instance, you know, not a real person, but a for instance of a person who might be seeking opioids even though he or she maybe shouldn't, given the addictive qualities?
Sure. And many people do struggle with pain because if you look at those co-occurring disorders, those chronic illnesses that are associated with the chronic illness of depression, you often in our population have people with severe diabetes and therefore they're in pain. They're in real pain from that. You know, sedentary lifestyles, smoking, a diet that isn't paid attention to all sort of contribute to those chronic diseases that are ongoing. So you're likely to find somebody who's going to present with all of those factors as well.
And then they seek opioids because it just numbs the pain.
Well, I think that's what I was saying, this sort of crossing between psychic pain and physical pain. And I will say that Dr. Sobelson is absolutely right. You know, the majority of medications, mental health medications, are prescribed by primary care physicians. And if we don't get to a point where we have proper integration of mental health and physical health, I think we're going to still struggle with some of these things.
Well, and Dr. Seitz, I can see you want to jump in. I want to get Dr. Turnbull in for just a second, too. Your sort of broad take, first of all, as a psychiatrist on the results of this study. Again, people with mental illness make up 16% of the U.S. population, but receive half of all opioid prescriptions.
Again, not surprising. I just want to thank our colleagues in family practice. As mentioned before, they tend to treat and see way more of the psychiatric folks than we do in psychiatry. They're burdened with a number of issues. First of all, a number of folks, probably about 60% of folks with mental illness, never seek out treatment in any given year. So you have the vast majority of people out there not even looking for treatment. If they do look for treatment, they end up usually finding that through family practice. And family practice is burdened by a number of limitations. First of all, a rapidly evolving psychiatric treatment profile of what we have, as well as having to try to tease out not only the mental aspects, but also the physical aspects with a focus on the physical as they go forward. In what appears to be very short amounts of time, we have a little bit more leeway in psychiatry once folks actually make it through the door into a psychiatry office. Unfortunately, the access to psychiatry is somewhat limited now across the state. So
do you think this is why we see this overprescribing for folks with mental illness of opioids, because they can't get into to see psychiatrists or mental health professionals?
I don't know if it's just an overprescribing of opioids. I think what ends up happening is people present to offices with a number of distress issues. Most of those tend to be focused on the physical. When you go and see a primary care practitioner, the focus there is on somatic-driven complaints rather than psychiatric. And given issues with time, there's not a lot of time to actually tease out what is psychiatric versus what is somatic. And I think the emphasis initially is on the somatic. Eventually, over time, if you have a relationship with the patient, over time you start to figure out that maybe some of this is related to more of a psychic component. We also know, too, that people that do seek out treatment have higher rates of pain complaints. May not have higher rates of pain, but actually have higher rates of pain complaints. So going forward, if you look at illnesses like major depression, 45% of those folks present with pain complaints. People with PTSD, about 30% of those people present with pain complaints. I'm not saying that those are all imagined, but they are definitely higher complaints. So those get taken, in quotation marks, seriously by family practitioners who want to try and do the best they can in a short amount of time for those folks.
So here's the chicken and egg question. I'll turn to you, Dr. Seitz. Do people with mental illness feel pain more acutely, or are they, you know, depressed because they're in chronic pain?
This is the billion-dollar question, and this is really where it gets interesting discussing the results of the study, because all we were able to demonstrate in the study is an association between getting an opioid prescription and the presence of a mental health disorder. We can't explain why that happened. We'll talk about that in this hour, which is kind of the fun stuff and interesting stuff. But I do want to say, without getting too technical and putting the audience to sleep, that we built some mathematical models in this paper where we took into account age, sex, race, health conditions, various levels of pain. And even when we did that, we still demonstrated a strong association between the presence of mental health disorders and the likelihood of getting a prescription from your physician, about twofold. So a lot of things we've already discussed in the group here could have been confounders, other things, other health conditions, pain levels. Because obviously if you're in lots of pain, you may be depressed because you're in pain.
Of course.
It has nothing to do with the mental health disorder. So it's very, very complicated.
So why do you think that you found this remarkable correlation?
So if you think about the factors that drive prescribing to a patient, there's four major factors: the patient, their background, their health history; the physician, their background, their training, their belief system; the unique health system that they're working in; and the overarching social regulatory policy that we all work under. And it may be that the presence of a mental health disorder influences those complex dynamics in some way to favor prescribing. It's possible that, for instance, this is an example, and this is my opinion, and it's not from the data. It could be that a physician, a family practice doctor on the front lines with a patient in their office, is overcompensating for somebody who, let's say, has advanced anxiety and has the possibility of little coping mechanisms. And it could be an overcompensation on behalf of the physician in an empathetic way. Patients with various mental health disorders may express their symptoms in a way that is different than someone without those disorders. The fascinating thing about pain, the definition is a subjective phenomena of actual or potential tissue injury. There is no measure for it. There is no biological measure for it. So this is all subjective. So the mind-body interactions here are very, very strong.
Well, and again, you said at the outset of the program that even with all these attempts through opioids to alleviate people's pain, and now we are a country awash in these, as you described, the CDC says our pain hasn't gotten any better.
It's remarkable.
I know you all have a lot more to say. I want to invite our listeners to join us. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Today in the exchange, we're looking at a new Dartmouth study which finds people with mental illness are much more likely to have opioid prescriptions, despite the risks that these drugs pose, especially for these patients. We'd love to hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Go ahead, Dr. Sobelson.
Well, I wanted to get back to, I think, something that Dr. Seitz just reemphasized and Dr. Turnbull certainly said. You can't separate out pain complaints from real pain. Pain is a subjective symptom by its own right, and there are no measures. So, in fact, the presence of someone who presents with low back pain, the presence or absence of arthritis or disc problems, is really to some extent independent of the pain complaints they might have. These are subjective phenomenon. So, when physicians and others are assessing them, the determination whether to prescribe or do anything else about it, by the way, is based on the degree of that subjective assessment. Interestingly, one of the things I thought about coming here today is that psychiatry is a bit of a subjective medical science. It's based on what people say and how they present themselves, unlike a lot of other areas of medical science. Now, it's great efforts have been made to make that subjective measures more standardized, but in the end, there's no blood test for depression or anxiety either. And therefore, the correlation of these two particularly subjective sciences, pain management and psychiatry, I think may almost be expected to fit together.
So go ahead, Peter Evers, yeah.
I mean, I think it's also about the environment that we're in. And, you know, I sort of coming from a different culture where there's universal healthcare, you have family docs, you know, who know families and they aren't actually subject to big pharma sort of pushing out their product as they have been here. And I think that's important because as a non-physician, I can say this, you know, that physicians' first thought is to ameliorate pain.
Absolutely.
And to make people feel better. So to be confronted with this idea of you shouldn't prescribe to this person because it might have problems down the road, when you don't have much time and you're looking at somebody in pain, physicians go into that work in order to ameliorate that pain. And that I think that's a huge piece of this. And on top of that, you have drug companies who, you know, frankly, have been pushing their medications not only to physicians but to people in the community in a way that around the world that has not happened. And I think that really has contributed to partly to this.
Well, and that gets back to the statistic that Dr. Seitz gave us at the beginning, that the United States consumes way, 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 way more opioids than anybody else. After a short break, we'll start taking your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
I was wondering.
I'm curious to know more about.
My question is, what is a filibuster?
How does the Electoral College work?
What is required for declaring war?
A majority whip.
Congressional caucuses.
You've got questions? We've got answers. Civics 101, the shame-free podcast refresher course on how our democracy works. There is no such thing as a stupid question. So ask away and subscribe to Civics 101 on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts.
Thank you so much. Keep up the excellent work.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what's behind the recent finding that a disproportionate number of opioid prescriptions are going to people with mental illness? A recent Dartmouth study finds that while people with mental illness make up just 16% of the U.S. population, they receive half of all opioid prescriptions. We're looking at that finding and what may be behind it, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And before we go to the phones, Dr. Turnbull, again, psychiatrist with the Mental Health Center of Greater Manchester, I want to ask you, should we assume that it's automatically a bad thing that so many Americans with anxiety and depression get half the country's opioids? Is it possible that these pills are making them feel better, might ease their pain, might ease their mental health problems?
I think the exact opposite. What we've noticed in psychiatry over the years, and there's been a lot of good research to show this, is once you actively treat psychiatric conditions in a way that you can get them into remission, particularly mood and anxiety issues, complaints of pain reduce markedly, and people's ability to function improves markedly. Depression by itself is one of the world's leading causes of disability and lack of functioning. So I think
physical functioning.
So I think there is a reason for us to be more active in the psychiatric realm, not only just in terms of trying to reduce the number of pain prescriptions, but actually working with folks to reduce the morbidity that comes along with psychiatric illnesses. So if we can do that more effectively, and that's not to say that we just do that through medications. Some of our most effective treatments in psychiatry are actually not medication-based, are actually therapy-based.
But insurance seems to prefer to pay for pills. It's a lot easier than, you know, months and months of weekly appointments with you, Dr. Turnbull.
The outcomes are a whole lot better when you at least combine medications and combine therapies. And oftentimes, therapies can actually get a lot of our patients into remission and actually get rid of some of the illnesses that they suffer from. And I'm talking mostly about when it comes to anxiety and depressive type issues. A multifaceted approach is what works the best. And even with a lot of pain complaints, things like fibromyalgia, which are fairly common when it comes to psychiatric folks, we find that even the recommendations for treatment there are based on therapy, diet, exercise, supplementations, way more than they are when it comes to any form of pain medications, muscle relaxants, and particularly when it comes to any form of opioids. So I think we can do a better job. I think, unfortunately, we're somewhat short-staffed in psychiatry, particularly when it comes to the treating those folks with more severe and persistent mental illnesses going forward.
So let me give a for instance. Let's say somebody comes into Dr. Solbelson's office and says, Dr. Solbelson, I'm in terrible pain and I'm, you know, throughout my whole body all the time. And he sends that person to you, Dr. Turnbull, for a psychiatric evaluation. You figure out that they actually have a psychiatric problem. You work on that and the pain might go away. Is it that simple?
It's not that simple. But what we've noticed with research over time is that if there is a diagnosis that we can actively treat, the subjective complaints of pain will reduce in that context. So it may mitigate anybody in family practice from having to prescribe higher potency medications.
That's interesting. Dr. Solbelson, I can see you want to jump in, and then lots of people who want to jump into our conversation as well.
Yes, just kind of building on that, I think the awareness of the concerns about opioid use has, in fact, extended to those four factors that Dr. Seitz commented on. So patients now come in and say, you know, I've been having this pain, but I don't necessarily want to be on opioids. I think these are problematic. And in addition to the lifestyle changes that I think people are always struggle to make with regard to exercise and better lifestyle decisions, there are an alternative medications that are now much more frequently used. Again, I think the study is phenomenal, but it does look back at a period of 2011 to 2013. And now we're talking about a greater period of awareness about opioid use. Physicians are under a great deal of pressure about how we prescribe these. So I think the use of alternate medications that are have to do with mood stabilization, anxiety management, antidepressants are very frequently moving up the ladder to be used by primary care physicians for people with chronic pain. And that's a good thing.
Although, you know, so you seem to be saying, Dr. Silbersohn, we're getting more savvy about opioids, doctors and patients coming in and saying, don't give me these. On the other hand, a headline just this morning, June had the highest number of overdose cases in 2017. So,
well, now you have to be careful.
Yeah.
I think there's a tendency in these conversations to kind of discuss opioid overprescribing, overdose deaths, which are due, frankly, not to the drugs we're prescribing. Now, these may be the entry drugs to those problems. But that has a lot to do with heroin and fentanyl and carfentanil. This is a different social psychological issue. I'm not saying they don't run together; they are important. But I think when you conflate those two, you create a little bit of misinformation.
So, and Dr. Seitz, real quick, because we have come around this issue twice. The idea that the study finished its findings in 2013.
2013. Correct.
So, do you think if you did it, measured using data from yesterday, right, it would be different?
Well, New Hampshire may be a little bit different statistics-wise. I mean, this is the United States population-based. We are in the midst of this crisis. It's growing. Our data is an underestimate. 2015 from the CDC is off the roofs with prescription opioids. I'm not as optimistic that we have figured out a strategy to solve this. And I do want to highlight that the major mechanism of driving the opioid epidemic isn't heroin. It is the opioid prescriptions.
And still, we do hear about the heroin, the carfentanil, fentanyl.
Right, but the prescription opioids are really, in essence, a gateway drug. 80% of the people who end up in rehab report they got it from their doctors to start with. It was too expensive. They couldn't get it. Heroin's cheaper. That story's been told, and that's still going on. So I think these really are merged, and we can control the prescribing and offering alternative approaches more so than dealing with border issues and drugs coming across, et cetera. So, I think,
all right.
Yeah.
Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. We'd love your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Mike's on the air from Hillsboro. Mike, thank you for calling in. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
I've worked for a number of years as a licensed clinical mental health counselor and LADAC, and I think the point I really wanted to emphasize was one that Dr. Turnbull commented on just a few minutes ago. I've actually worked with Quentin for a number of years, and that is the kind of predisposition to turn towards medication in general as the answer to our psychological, physical, emotional difficulties, versus the panoply of skills available for managing emotions, managing depression, managing anxiety. It's been an uphill fight for me as a clinician to try to emphasize this message, but I would even comment on a more overarching concept that as a society in general, we tend to turn towards the idea of medication first, and then lifestyle change, skills usage as kind of a distant second.
And Mike, LADAC means Licensed Alcohol and Drug Abuse Counselor, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay.
Yes.
And so why do you think that's the case, Mike?
Well, it's probably a whole other show, Laura.
Yeah.
It's probably a rather complicated set of factors that maybe go back as far as the beginning of the 20th century when we had this wonderful discovery of medications that would cure things that had long been uncurable, and kind of the mentality in society in general became, something's wrong with me, I go to the doc, he gives me something to fix it, as opposed to something's wrong with my life, what adjustments can I make to manage this effectively?
Okay. Very good to hear from you, Mike. Thank you so much for calling in. And Peter Evers, what do you think?
Well, that was a great call from Mike, and he's a MLADAC. There are, I think, 250 MLADACs in the state at the moment.
And again, MLADAC is what?
Well, that's a person with a master's who can bill individually. We have a workforce problem as well, which we really need to talk about. You know, Quentin was talking about being a psychiatrist. The average age of a psychiatrist in the U.S. is 58. Quentin's not in that. We are also freshly minting 1,100 psychiatrists a year in the country.
So, not very much in the whole country. Wow.
Right. So we're losing expertise. We're hiring APRNs, but we have to do something about that. In New Hampshire, it's even worse than that because we have the pull of a state slightly to the south of us in terms of the younger population leaving. And that's relative to social workers and mental health counselors as well. If we don't address that issue, the issue of being able to hire and keep those people who are involved in this complex process of providing an array of services that help medications as well, then we're really going to continue to struggle and sort of have a fallback on prescribing medications that essentially mask pain rather than treat pain.
So is it that this whole culture of, you know, I don't feel good physically or mentally, I go to the doctor, I say, please give me a pill, he or she gives me one, I walk away happy. I mean, whose fault is that? Is that the insurance system? Is it the patient themselves who doesn't really want to, you know, lose 50 pounds? Is it or meditate and deal with, you know, mental health issues? Is it the doctor who is under pressure? You only have 20 minutes with these persons, so, you know, let's get you out the door quickly and thank you very much.
I think it's the pressure, the downward pressure on providers to do more and more and more in shorter periods of time. And insurance companies, I'm sorry, but I think they have to accept some responsibility in the rates that they pay and the productivity that is required to get there.
Go ahead, Dr. Solbeson, and then Dr. Seitz.
I think that's a wonderful question. And again, I think it does build on Mike's call. You can't ignore the cultural aspects of what pain means in American society when you look at data like this and when you compare us to anywhere else. Physicians who travel abroad who do work in third world countries will often comment on this. I distinctly remember a local otolaryngologist who would go down to Nicaragua to do tonsillectomies during his time off. And he said, you know, in the United States, when you do a tonsillectomy on a child, the parents, this was years ago, would be extraordinarily anxious about pain, would go home with powerful narcotics, often a week or two of long-term pain medication. When you do a tonsillectomy on a child in Nicaragua, the parents, there's no pain. They finish the operation. They have a little discomfort. There's a cultural different perception of what to expect. And pain is deeply built into that. Now, we have built a lot of structure around that with regard to the medical system, the insurance system, the way things get done. And cultural things are very hard to change.
That's really interesting. And Dr. Seitz, one of the things that jumped out for me from your study is you said repeatedly, we need to build a better infrastructure for dealing with pain. And this relates to Mike's call as well. He's saying, and I know you agree, you know, this sort of give me a pill and I go away happy isn't good enough.
Right. I mean, there's a general consensus in the medical community that we're likely overprescribing opioids based on that statistic of us consuming the majority of the world's opioids. And so if you're going to decrease opioid prescribing, you have to do one of two things, actually. One is you have to figure out what are your goals of therapy with opioids. Is it patient satisfaction or is it functional improvement in the patient's lives? That's the first thing. We haven't really figured that out yet. Washington State has new guidelines that center around functional improvements and reductions in disability to guide opioid therapy. But that's kind of bold because then suddenly the patient's voice and satisfaction is kind of taken out of the equation. And that's somewhat controversial. The other issue is you need to replace opioids with something.
Right. And what else is there that is, you know, not that expensive and, you know, makes people feel better?
So there's a range of options. There's some non-opioid pharmaceuticals that are effective. There's cognitive behavioral therapy. There's meditation. There's acupuncture. There's acupressure, massage therapy. But you need an infrastructure to support these things and deliver them. So if the family practice doctor has 8 patients waiting in the office, someone comes in with a pain condition, you have to be able to efficiently and effectively kick off this infrastructure to support the patient. And
well,
that does not exist currently.
The infrastructure is not there. And a lot of those things that do help with pain, massage, acupuncture, you know, whatever, they're not paid for. You have to pay out of pocket. It's $75. It's $100. Maybe you have to go once a week. So it's easy to say we need this infrastructure, but someone is going to have to cough up the bucks for that.
Absolutely. And that is a challenging economic story. And I'd be happy to be part of that solution, but I don't have the actual answer right here.
First things first. I understand. Go ahead, Dr. Sobelson, then back to our callers.
You know, the good news about this study is that it does suggest part of the answer to what I think Dr. Sykes is saying. Is, you know, because we know who the high-use population is, and it's not everybody. It's 20% of the population who are high users. So, in fact, what have we been talking about, and you've talked about it on other programs, our underfunding of the mental health system is pushing these patients out. And, in fact, while we won't solve the opioid overprescribing by focusing on this generally, we've been talking about general principles, perhaps a dedicated focus to the population that's overusing is called for by this study.
So now we know that this population in particular getting half the opioid prescriptions, so maybe that's an area of focus. I see what you're saying there. Yeah, go ahead.
I agree with the point exactly. I think there has to be more education in terms of identifying those folks, and not only identifying those folks, but trying to figure out what we can do in the context of which of those folks we can adequately treat in a family setting versus a psychiatric setting, and have that accessibility, which is becoming less and less common to have that accessibility to skilled psychiatrists in a community setting.
Given how much of a shortage there is, and we've talked about that. Let's go back to our listeners. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Elizabeth is in Manchester. Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You were just talking about acupuncture, and I was calling in about House Bill 575. It just passed the House and the Senate unanimously. It is a bill that will allow recovery workers, mental health care professionals to train and certify as acupuncture detoxification specialists with the training from the National Acupuncture Detoxification Association. They've been around since the 1980s. The ear acupuncture protocol that they train was developed in the 1970s during a heroin epidemic in the South Bronx, but it has also been proven to be helpful for depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, mental and behavioral health. And so that is an affordable way to incorporate some acupuncture into working with people who are struggling with addiction and mental health.
So, Elizabeth, back up for a second. So who is going to be able to provide this now?
It will be all kinds of addiction recovery workers, all the way down to peer counselors, certified recovery workers, LADACs. It's a very, really good bill. It's a very flexible bill. And we had great legislators who helped push the bill through the State House, and also mental and behavioral health practitioners.
How did the professional acupuncturists feel about this, Elizabeth? Did they feel like, not sure if I want, you know, pardon the expression, amateurs doing this?
So it was split, and you had some who were for it and some who were against it. However, this organization, NADA, the National Acupuncture Detoxification Association, has been around a very long time. The protocol itself was not solely developed only by acupuncturists. So acupuncturists cannot claim sole ownership of this ear acupuncture protocol.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
And not well, only that, but, I mean, other states have this legislation. There's never been a single malpractice insurance claim against an acupuncture detoxification specialist.
All right. Well, Elizabeth, good to hear from you. And coming up after a short break, we can take some more questions and comments, but maybe also pick up on Elizabeth's point, and also the point that you keep making, Dr. Seitz, is that, you know, we don't do a great job offering people alternatives from pain. That's why we've seen some of this opioid problem. So we'll pick up on that in just a minute, and we'll continue to hear from you. So join us, 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today we're digging into a new Dartmouth study that finds people with mental illness are much more likely to get opioid prescriptions, despite the risks these drugs pose, especially for these patients. We're looking at possible explanations and how to find our way out of this problem. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Peter Evers with Riverbend Community Mental Health, I want to turn to you on Elizabeth's call. Very excited about being able to use acupuncture to treat addiction and pain. Just more broadly, if you could, Peter, what access do you see among your patients at Riverbend to alternative therapies that might ease their pain and even their mental suffering?
Yeah, it was a great call because it's sort of, if I could broaden that a little bit and talk about peers in the workplace, I believe that having people with lived experience helping in the treatment intervention is as helpful as a clinical intervention. It is proven that peers in these settings really help people's recovery, both in mental health and substance use disorder. New Hampshire hasn't had a way to pay for those. We've been looking for a waiver from Medicaid to do that. And I think that leads us into the question of payment reform. It's estimated that there's $750 billion of waste in our health system.
Wow.
And that's 18% of our GDP.
And define waste, by the way.
Well, MRIs that are ordered when they shouldn't be, medications that are 90 days worth of a prescription when you only need 3 or 4 days worth of pain medication.
Treatments that you get that don't work? Does that count as waste?
Interventions that don't work. And that's partly based on encounter-based care. In the medical system at the moment, we get paid for an encounter delivered. That's how.
Still, yeah. Fee for service.
Yeah. Well, actually, the mental health system in Medicaid is the only system that is in an at-risk contract for service delivered under a cap. But my point is that—
What does that mean?
That means that we would get a certain amount of money per month for a person, regardless of what their needs are. So there's a little bit of a bell curve. If somebody has serious mental illness, then they need residential care. We would lose on that person. If somebody doesn't need residential care and needs community-based services, we would win on that. And so the idea is to hit the middle so that you can use those resources in different ways rather than just getting encounters. It is, well, let's measure ourselves on how people are getting better. And it sounds like an outrageous notion, but we need to get to payment reform so that we're actually seeing that our interventions work, they're evidence-based, that we're using acupuncture, for example, or peers in the workplace, and then we're judged on the interventions that we have that actually make people better.
That's interesting. So it kind of opens up the availability of options to treat anxiety, depression, pain, rather than someone predetermining, we're going to cover this, but not this, we're going to cover this, but not this. That's it, opens it up. If it works, you get paid. If it doesn't work, you don't get paid.
Well, there's a net risk piece to that. And Medicare certainly has been in the middle of, we're in the middle of one of those projects at the moment. But this is the way that we have to go, because we have to be able to describe ourselves as a clinical process that makes better outcomes for human beings, and not to the mother may I, which is the could I have authorization to provide this service, and it's the only service that I can access, as opposed to all of these other issues that would address social determinants of health. We have a joke around, why can't a physician prescribe fresh fruit, for instance? You know, so we're beginning to have conversations about those other things that affect people's health, and how can we draw those services in to be a part of the solution to better health for people overall.
That's really interesting. Go ahead, Dr. Seitz.
So there was a fascinating study, I think it was 2014, called The Cost of Satisfaction. And the research is actually using the same data, publicly available data that we use in our study, determined that patients who rank their satisfaction the highest compared to those that did not had a 20 to 23% increased likelihood of death. And that was attributed to overprescribing, overtreatment. So patients like to get things. Drugs, procedures, imaging, especially when their deductibles met, and so there was a concern that this is reflecting the harms that the health system could generate with various interventions and procedures. And so prescribing is right in there. And so we're stuck in this reimbursement model of medicine that patient satisfaction really drives things, which is good, right? It's led to a lot of quality improvement issues in medicine. But the question is, could satisfaction not necessarily be correlated with good outcomes? And that's where it gets sticky, and we have to explore more.
Those surveys that you get every time you go for even just a routine, quick, you know, check, and then you get a letter. I still get letters in the mail all the time. Did you see Dr. So-and-so? Did Dr. So-and-so, you know, listen to your concerns? Did Dr. So-and-so give you what you need? Are you feeling better since you saw Dr. So-and-so? Those satisfaction surveys, if I don't get the opioids I want from you, well, so I'm going to give you a bad review.
Yes, that's the concern. And so if you guys want to comment on that, I'm not on the front lines of in the clinic. I'm an acute care physician, so that's less of a concern for me. But what I've heard from frontline providers is that if you have an unhappy patient with respect to pain management, that's a problem. Even if you don't think that the opioid therapy is necessarily the right strategy and you want to do cognitive behavioral therapy, but they're like, no way.
What do you think, Dr. Turnbull? Patients like to, and you know, everybody's who's in pain, guilty as charged. I mean, the first thing you want when you're in pain is the pain to stop. So patients like to get something. It's understandable.
I think people want to have sort of this immediate satisfaction, and that's part of oftentimes what puts us at risk for addictions. If there's any delayed gratification, if you went down to Mohegan Sun and you pulled the one-arm banded lever and they got back to you 3 months from now to let you know if you'd won something, you wouldn't spend the whole night pulling the lever.
No, you
There's
would not.
There's immediate gratification. And people do want the best results, in quotation marks, with the least amount of effort. And that I think that's all of us. We're all looking for that magic pill. You just look on TV. You know, you can go in and have surgery done and have fat removed that took 20 years to remove before you can have it done in 2 days with a payment plan. So I think we have to let people know that there are very effective treatments psychiatrically for a number of the issues we've talked about today. But they take time and they take effort, and people have to be willing to do that. And not everybody is willing to do
that.
Right.
They have to come see you once or twice a week initially. But also there is, we keep getting back to this like a broken record, but you know, a lot of times even if someone is willing to go to the physical therapist mm-hmm. twice a week or come mm-hmm. see you, Dr. Turnbull, twice a week, insurance doesn't cover it. It gets quite pricey.
It's easier just to pop a pill. It's easier,
and cheaper.
But it doesn't have the long-term benefits. You know, what we try to instill in the folks that we see is this long-term benefit of hope and recovery. And we try to get people into a sense of, you know, we can have a different life. And hopefully, I think most physicians are trying to do that, but with time limitations and pressures and so much stuff happening at any one time, it's incredibly difficult. And I can't imagine being a family practitioner in this environment. It's a struggle being a psychiatrist in this environment. And we face differences with different medications in the psychiatric setting, not just with opioids. We face difficulties with benzodiazepines and amphetamine-type stimulant medications that people want because they want, again, they want that immediate resolution of symptoms. But it's not feasible in the long term. It's not something that's going to work long term. If anything, it's going to actually worsen your quality of life. Folks that prescribe opioids know that people with back pain that get on long-term opioid medications and prescriptions actually have a worse quality of life going forward. There are no improvements with that.
Because they haven't done the work to recover. It's just masking the pain. But again, when you're in pain,
you want that immediate
relief. You can't stand it. Right.
So we have to work on options, and we have to work on instilling hope in people that there is recovery.
Let's take another call, and this is Dee in Pembroke. Hi, Dee. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Laura.
Hi.
I had knee replacement surgery. I'm in my 70s, and I have some grueling physical therapy I'm doing 3 times a day, and I'm afraid to take the medication because of a possible addiction down the road and getting off of it. But yet they say if I don't take it, then I'll likely not benefit from the, you know, the exercises.
I see. So
between a rock and a place.
So reduce your pain so that you can benefit from the exercises, Dee?
Yes. Yeah. The physical therapy and yet, you know, and also be able to sleep at night.
Right. So do you not take opioids at all? Are you taking, like, Advil or Tylenol?
Well, they gave me some.
Yeah. Well, and I would never put any doctor on this panel, you know, in the position of, you know, giving somebody medical advice. Dr. Solbelson, you know, on the air, obviously you don't know D, but in general, you know, people walk out of surgery sometimes with pockets full of opioids and they don't know what to do. They don't want to take them. On the other hand, we're told Tylenol's bad for your liver, you know. Motrin is bad for your stomach. So it's kind of, you know, what are you supposed to do?
Well, I think Dee's example comes back to, again, what's been talked about before. Here there was an expectation. So after you have a total knee replacement, it's going to hurt. It's probably going to hurt for weeks, maybe months. But somehow in our society, and I don't want to throw any of my orthopedic colleagues under the bus, we've created an expectation that by having this surgery, things will be better. Well, they probably will be better in the long run.
Down the road.
But if you sort of said to people, gee, after the surgery, you're going to have, if you did it like those drug ads on TV, you know, we'll replace your knee, but you can expect for the next 3 to 4 weeks to have searing pain, difficulty sleeping, etc. Well, you're not going to sell who's going to help sell your operation?
Right.
So I do think this concept of expectation, which merges into exactly what we talked about with satisfaction and a consumerist society. And you put that together with the biochemistry available to us through these drugs and the way we get paid, and you pretty much have built what we've created. Again, I do want to be more optimistic. I think what the legislature and others have pushed back on and said, all well and good, but it's now time to you know, at least lock the door of the candy store so you have to buzz to come in. Is a good thing, and I do believe that while we're putting in our office huge amounts of energy into remaining in compliance with these new laws, I do think it's having the outcome that was expected, that emergency departments are not sending people home with 100 Percocets. Surgeons are not sending people home with 30-day supplies. And physicians are thinking about those alternatives, although, again, as we've talked about, having challenges getting people to consider them.
Although I brought my 17-year-old in to look at the possibility of getting his wisdom teeth removed. 17, so we know the young brain, highly open to addiction. And they did say, and we'll give you some, you know, we'll give your son some opioids afterwards. And I said, no, you will not. So it's still out there. Peter Evers, what about the brain of the person who has anxiety, mood disorders, depression? Do we know if that brain is more open to addiction?
I think vulnerable is probably the best word. I mean, we know in statistics that 60 to 65 people who struggle with severe mental health problems also struggle with addiction, whatever that might be.
It's that co-occurring that you talked
about
earlier.
It is. And you know, I know this isn't about alcohol, but we really need to remain cognizant that alcoholism is a bigger killer in this state in terms of that disease. I think, yes, there's a vulnerability. Also, you know, I would say, take the Medicaid population. We have 187,000 people on Medicaid in this state, and that's around about 10% of the population. It's also 10% of the poorest people that we provide services for. These block grants that people are talking about are nothing but disaster for that population if we're not able to help them. And yes, they are more vulnerable because their life circumstances are unhappy in many ways because of poverty issues. Issues with the justice system involvement, secure housing, for instance. You know, there is a lot to escape from in terms of that torment. And so, yes, I would say that's a vulnerable person as opposed to a brain that is tracked to that.
Here's an email that I want to share with all of you. Wayne raises an important point, and Wayne, thank you. He says, do any of these folks ever think about the fact that this hysteria over opiates has scared docs into taking patients who truly need the pain relief and forcing them to reduce or eliminate their pain medications? Wayne says, I have a friend who has spinal stenosis. Her spinal column is virtually crushing her cord, and she has been forced to reduce her pain meds. Whereas before she could still bear the pain, though she still had some, now she's in constant pain, and it is no wonder she is depressed. If any doc says that pain meds are a gateway, they need to face the fact that they open the gate, and then when they take away the medication from people who truly need it, we have addressed a problem by creating another. Wayne, thank you so much. And Dr. Seitz, I did want to ask that question, the concern that some people, whether they have mental illness or not, are now being denied pain medications that could help, like Wayne's friend?
On an individual level, as I mentioned before, opioid therapy may be absolutely the right drug, and that's a decision between the physician and the patient. My point earlier on was that on a population health level, we've done the national experiment. We are getting the world's opioids, and we have not been able to demonstrate improvements in disability or pain on a national level. So it's making us think about who, what, where, when, how. And opioid therapy is a mainstay for pain, and I'm unaware of any physician that wants to take people off of a drug that's working for them. I think the larger issue is how do we prevent people from getting on these drugs in the first place through prescribing policies and offer alternative therapies that are safer and as effective. And
I think offer that, and pay for, because
offer,
we keep talking
right,
about
right.
You
offer
know,
pay for. So
you
it's
can
about,
offer everything, but right. it's expensive.
Right. So it's about alternatives that work and that are safer. And so my heart goes out to people suffering in chronic pain. And if opioid therapy is the right therapy for them, they should be on it.
Well, Wayne, thank you so much for the email. Important point, Dr. Sobelson.
Yeah, I would also want to reemphasize, I think what Wayne says is true. There is a judgment going on now, and there are physicians who are saying, sorry, I won't take on a patient who's on opioids. In fact, I'm aware of physicians, and this is actually more the norm than the not, who will review patients' records ahead of time if they're considering a new patient, and if they are on chronic opioids, will not accept them into their practices. Now, I don't know where these patients eventually get their care. I'm thinking
maybe
of a
they're
patient.
The ones who turn to the street, like you said earlier.
I am thinking of a patient who I inherited, though, from another colleague who was on the equivalent of 200 milligrams of morphine a day, way beyond the amount that I should be, had mental health problems. And I said to him, I just can't continue to do that in good faith, and had to begin to taper him because it was the right thing to do. And again, there were psychiatric mental health correlates to those cases. It's
wow.
a very challenging problem.
Well, there are 16 more things we could have talked about, but we've run out of time for today. I hope you all come back, and we'll pick up on some of the threads that have come out this hour. Dr. Turnbull, it was really good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you.
That's Dr. Quentin Turnbull, psychiatrist with the Mental Health Center of Greater Manchester. Dr. Sobelson, thank you for taking time out. Gary Sobelson, family physician with Concord Family Medicine. Peter Evers, good to have you too. Thank you for your time. Peter Evers, president and CEO of Riverbend Community Mental Health and vice president for behavior health at Concord Hospital. And Dr. Brian Seitz, thank you so much for being here. Good luck as this study goes forward. I appreciate it. That's Dr. Brian Seitz. Again, he is co-author of the study that we talked about concerning opioids and people with mental health disorders. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.